Here's a little music to hold you off while we're getting things organized here in the studio.
No. We're in heart promotion.
I'm crazy. Crazy for feeling so lonely. Crazy. Crazy for feeling so blue. I knew you'd love me as long as you wanted, and then someday you'd leave me for somebody new. Worry, why do I let myself worry? Wondering, what in the world did I do? And I'm crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. Crazy for trying, crazy for crying. And I'm crazy for loving you. Original title of that song, I don't know if you ever knew this or not.
You didn't tell the story behind that song, no.
The original title. It was one of those songs that I wrote that week. You know, it was the second song of that week.
It was the last one, right?
The original title was Stupid. But it didn't sound very euphonious. So a little known fact.
I want to do the title song from my last CD. It's called Unchained.
When the evening sun goes down, you're gonna find me hanging around. The nightlife ain't no good life, but it's my life. Many people, just like me.
This is Brooks' wake-up call, waking up to the alternative news that the commercial media doesn't often present. We're glad to be with you this afternoon. We're on from 5 to 6. We always have some really interesting guests, and also we play some really terrific music. Play music from some of our favorite activist musicians. And did you have something for us today to look forward to? Or do you know what we're going to play yet? The music.
No.
Oh, okay. It's going to be a surprise. Be prepared.
We've already had the intro music.
Okay. Today, we have two guests. One is one of our dear Wilp sisters, Ruth Self, who's been on before and on whom we rely for many things. And she has brought with her somebody that she met that she wanted us all to know more about, Robert Childs. And can you tell us, Ruth?
Yes. Well, I heard Robert Childs, and when I heard about harm reductionist, I thought, what is a harm reductionist? Does he tell you about good food to eat so you don't get harmed by poisonous fish or poison turkey? Is he a harm reductionist trying to warn you about not having locks on your guns that can kill your children? So when I found out what it was about, I said, boy, oh boy, everyone should know what Robert Childs does, so I brought him over to interview him today.
Great.
Why Are you having a conference on drug use in the South? What does drug use have to do with harm reduction?
Sure, that's a really great question. And first of all, I just want to say thanks for having me here today. I'm really excited and honored to be able to be here. And I'm very excited that you asked that question, because we're actually hosting a conference on drug use in the South on September 8th and 9th at Research Triangle Institute right outside of Durham. And what's going on with drugs in North Carolina is they're kind of overtaking the state. We have over 50,000 injection drug users, over 170,000 crack users. We gave out 17 million prescriptions for oxycodone for our 9 million residents. So, I mean, if you didn't get your two prescriptions last year, somebody else got yours.
Why do you need a prescription for oxycodone?
Well, some people don't. But the but basically what's happening is we have a lot of people without health care in North Carolina. And what's happening with that group is they oftentimes are working blue-collar jobs, which oftentimes leads to them getting injured on the job. However, they all have families and rent to pay, children to feed, people to put in school, families to take care of. And what happens is if they don't have health care, they can't go to the doctor to get their pain treated. So they take matters into their own hands and take oxycodone or Percocet, for example. And what happens then is they're managing their pain by themselves, which makes them really, really high risk for drug overdose. And what's happening is, in North Carolina, drug overdose is the fourth leading cause of death.
Fourth.
For 18 to 50-year-olds. And it's a lot of it's got to do with this self-pain management that's going on. And also, we don't have a really good mental health infrastructure in the state of North Carolina. And what happens is, if you don't have a really good mental health infrastructure, is a lot of people who need social services don't get them. And when they don't get them, they self-medicate. And what do they self-medicate with? Is with illegal drugs and alcohol, and sometimes legal drugs, but they're getting them from their friends. And what happens then is when those mix, they're really high rate of people OD on them, and most people don't even know how to recognize an
overdose. What do they mix? They mix alcohol with?
It could be alcohol with oxycodone. It could be heroin and cocaine. It could be Percocet and Oxy. It could be fentanyl with something. It's pretty much any drug. And what happens is if we start putting drugs in our body and don't know what can happen if we mix them, oftentimes people are very prone to overdoses. Mm. And they oftentimes look like somebody just passed out. And if I don't know anything about this person, I just presume they passed out of alcohol and leave them be. Mm. And that's why we have a really high death rate. Wilkes County, for example, in North Carolina, had one of the highest drug overdose rates out of any county in the United States. It was worse than New York, worse than L.A. And the reason for that is because they had a stack of blue-collar workers without health care who were self-medicating and people who didn't know how to recognize it. So there was actually a great group called Project Lazarus, which started working with the county and reducing that. And they've actually reduced the overdose rate there quite a bit. But the big problem is it isn't just located in Wilkes County. It's a statewide issue.
I wanted to ask if there's any harm reduction. It's kind of an obvious term, but is it really as obvious as the terminology implies, or is there more to it?
Yeah, I can give you I'll give you the standard definition, and then I'll give you my barbecue-based definition, because we're a Southern radio show, so we should talk in the Southern style.
Right.
So we are civilized. The classical definition is harm reduction refers to a range of public health policies designed to reduce harmful consequences associated with drug use, sex work, and other high-risk activities. Harm reduction is put forth as a useful perspective alongside the more conventional approaches of demand and supply reduction. And so I'm going to define that in a barbecue sense. So say, for example, there's a great barbecue going on right outside of Pittsburgh, and I live over in Durham. So if I don't have any mass transit, how am I going to get there in a safe way? The only way you could really get over there is to drive a car. Now, I don't know if anybody's read any statistics on driving a car, but it's like one of the most dangerous things you can do. Like, the only thing that happens in car is death, injury, pain, suffering, and tears.
Yes,
I don't know anything else that happens in a car.
I've been through it.
Right?
Yes.
So we know that if you drive a car, you're going to get injured, right? Every human knows this. However, we all take our lives into our own hands every single time that we're driving over to Mama's Barbecue outside of Pittsburgh, right? And we cannot go because it's delicious, right? Mm-hmm. Her pulled pork sandwiches are awesome, right? It's not like that wimpy Western style. It's Eastern Carolina vinegar-based deliciousness, right? You can't say no. You got to get over there. So I'm making a conscious decision to get over there. So I can't be abstinent from my car. There's no other way to get over there, right? So I decide I'm going to do it. So how can I do it? I can take a harm reduction approach when I drive, right? So the harm reduction approach would be to use a seatbelt, would be to drive a Volvo because they're safe, to have airbags in your vehicle, to have side impact beams. Those are all harm reduction to an inherent dangerous behavior. And so that's the approach when but people, you know, we can take the same to drugs. Like, are drugs 100% safe? No. Can we make them safer? Absolutely, right? So we can teach people if they're going to administer drugs with a needle, you can do it in a safer way. If you're going to take drugs via the smoke, you can do it in a safer way. If I'm going to take pills, I can do it in a safer way, so we're decreasing harm to individuals and society.
Very interesting. Wow. You know, I'm learning so much already, and I thought I knew so much. Boy, oh boy.
So tell us about the needles and who uses needles and what is the big problem with a needle.
Sure. I'm so glad you asked that question. So the big problem with needles in North Carolina is they're partially criminalized, which means if I don't have a prescription for it, I can be arrested for it. So why is that a problem? So we have 50,000 people who inject drugs. We have around 700,000 people who are diabetics. Who tends to be diabetics? It's normally people in North Carolina who tend to be low income and tend to not have health care, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, there are exceptions and mad speed around that, but a lot of them don't have health care, right? So what do they do if they need a needle to administer insulin? They go to the pharmacy. Can the pharmacist discriminate against somebody who wants to purchase a needle? Absolutely. It's at the pharmacist's discretion. So what do we know about that? We know from studies from Research Triangle Institute, based out of the Triangle, that minorities are 8 times less likely to be sold a syringe in the Triangle, which means if it's out of the Triangle, it's a lot worse. So we know minorities aren't being sold syringes. That's a problem. Also, in rural areas, what happens is if I need a syringe, even if it's to administer a cancer med or something like that, if the pharmacist doesn't feel like you deserve it, right, because it's at their discretion, or like I know that person and they're troubled, they shouldn't be getting a syringe, even though I might need it for a totally legitimate reason, they can say no.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
What do you mean that they're buying needles that you may intend to use for medical reasons?
Sure.
I thought there were almost like these ads about getting your needles.
Well, the funny thing is you can order them through the mail.
Yes. I guess that's what I was
saying. Yeah, and so you can do that.
It's thinking ahead, of course.
Yeah. And like, but a lot of people, they don't have access to the web, don't have access to TV. Like, they're not going to know this. And so that's a big problem.
But it's partially, in other words, if you had bought some needles and you got stopped by the cops and they searched your car, then if you had needles and you couldn't produce a prescription,
you can be arrested. Yeah. And so that's a big problem. And the other big problem is law enforcement don't like the rule, because what happens when we have a silly law like this is people who have syringes who don't have a prescription or are afraid due to their race, right, that they may be arrested purely because of their race with the syringe, is that they don't tell them they have it. So when the police do pat downs, they get needle sticks. So then the police are getting HIV, viral hepatitis B, viral hepatitis C, abscesses, and all kinds of needle related, you know, exposures.
Unintended consequences
And so 1 in 3 members of law enforcement get a needle stick in their career in North Carolina.
Oh my gosh.
28% of them get multiple needle sticks in their career. I got people over at the Greensboro Sheriff who've been stuck multiple times. I talked to a guy recently in Concord, North Carolina. He'd been stuck 6 times in the last couple of years. And it's really common. And the other problem is, you know, the law enforcement are not the only people who are hurting, right? And so when they are hurting, guess what departments don't do? They don't buy needle stick resistant gloves. And we're one of the, I think we're the actual only trainer on how to work with people with needles on them in the state. And we mostly just train in Central Carolina. So, like, folks around here oftentimes don't know what to do if they encounter something like that. And most of them don't have trainings. And it's really sad because it affects law enforcement who are just trying to do their job. And it affects people who need to inject their HIV meds, right? Mm-hmm. North Carolina, we have a crazy waiting list for getting on the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, mm-hmm. and you pretty much have to be bankrupt to get on it, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a big problem. So a lot of people have to inject this medication called Fuzion, which is a basic HIV med for one, you know, and we have 35,000 people in North Carolina who have HIV, and it's really important for them to access syringes, and oftentimes they're afraid to. The other big problem is people with viral hepatitis B and C oftentimes have to administer medications via syringe. Mm-hmm. And there's 750,000 people who have viral hepatitis in North Carolina.
750,000.
Yes.
And
one
so
in
they
12.
Are using their needles over and over again.
So people will have to reuse needles. With that group, what's happening is if they are able to get treatment is oftentimes they're going to have to inject a medication. And if most of the people who have hepatitis, not all of them, but a lot of them have had a history of drug use. And so they're the ones that the cops oftentimes know. So they're the ones who are the most worried about having a syringe as well. So that leads to all kinds of complications as well.
Wow. And are the needles left open? They're not capped after they're used?
Well, the big problem in North Carolina is if I have a syringe, especially if I've done anything naughty with it, what's going to do is I'm going to hide that thing. And I probably, my buddies and I are all going to share it because none of us want to carry a syringe on us. So what happens is viral hepatitis can live 3 to 6 months in a syringe, right? Right.
Oh.
Yeah. So like anybody who uses that thing is probably definitely getting hep C. We test people for hep C and 80% of the people we test turn up positive for hep C. Mm-hmm. And they're also really likely to get HIV. Now, if I'm, you know, if I'm not a human rights person, if I'm not a public health person, why should I even care about that, right? The reason why you should care, because I'm a fiscal conservative, right? The reason I care is each HIV infection that happens with it is it costs taxpayers $660,000 for each HIV infection to the state. So that's, we're just talking a medical cost. We're not talking about lost work.
Okay.
We're not talking about like them not dedicating to the tax base.
Talking about
just medical costs.
$660,000 yeah. per person.
Yeah.
For health care costs.
Yeah.
Speak a little slower so people can get this because yeah. I was just so absolutely chagrined to find this out.
Yeah. Yes, me too.
Yeah, and then the other problem with it is if they get hepatitis C, it costs $120,000 to treat. And if they require a liver transplant because hepatitis attacks the liver, that costs $500,000. And there's 750,000 people with hepatitis B and C in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it's due to the syringe access issue. A lot of it is people getting hepatitis from not being able to have protected sex. A lot of folks also get it from sharing crack pipes. And so there's a lot of issues with all those things.
All right, I wanted to ask you about drug users doing sex work.
Yes.
The connection between the two. Because
yes.
we didn't know that there were sex workers in North Carolina for a long time.
Ooh, they're everywhere. Yeah, I haven't gone to a town, I haven't run into them. So
by sex workers, I take it the definition would be what we old-fashioned used to call prostitutes. Or
you could label it as that,
I mean,
yeah.
Is that sort of what we're talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah, they're just people who exchange sex for goods and services.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it could be somebody who's exchanging some tuition assistance.
Uh-huh.
It could be somebody who's getting housing. It could be somebody who's going to a doctor and exchanging medical services for
mm-hmm.
a little bit of love. It could be somebody who's exchanging it for drugs. It could be somebody who's exchanging it for money. It could be somebody who's exchanging it for childcare.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be any
wow.
of those. And it doesn't matter on the gender, it, mm-hmm. both sides. So we have male sex workers, trans sex workers, and female sex
mm-hmm.
workers, and intersex sex workers.
In what?
Intersex?
What's that?
It's when people have both sexual organs. So it's people who are born, for example, with ovaries and testes.
Okay.
And it does happen, actually, at a surprisingly.
Okay.
And so they oftentimes, like, I don't personally identify them as trans. Like, I view them as somebody who's a bit of both. And sometimes they will identify trans or will identify as female or male, but it kind of depends on the individual.
Okay, so back to the risks for sex workers. And I think you said about the connection between sex workers and what?
And drug use.
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about two major examples, which are the LGBTQI folks and then the other folks. And when I say LGBTI, I mean lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, and intersex. And what's happening with those groups is normally, especially if they come out at a young age, they're oftentimes kicked out by their family and basically given nothing. And so what happens is they'll normally spend, if they have a friend, they'll probably spend a couple weeks to a couple months with them, but inevitably they're probably going to have to figure something else on their own. So especially the young people, what we're really worried about is they have no opportunities for work, especially the folks who are identifying as trans. And what happens is they can't get work anywhere. The only place they can get work is by selling themselves. And so a lot of our young people who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, or intersex start selling their bodies in exchange for rent, exchange for food, just exchange for basic life necessities. And the big problem with that is, I don't know if any of you, if you lost your housing and had to pay for your housing because if you lost your housing and your job and the only option was sex work, if you could do that sober. I couldn't, right? I'd want to be high or drunk because I can't do that sober. So what happens is they oftentimes take drugs in order to do the work to meet the basic life necessities that they need. And what happens in exchange is they oftentimes become addicted to the drug that helps them do it, and then they're doing sex work not only for the basic life necessities
but for the drug. Vicious cycle.
Yeah, and normally what will happen, especially if they're rookies at doing sex work, is they're going to be picked up by the police at some point. So then they have a criminal record, then they're never going to get a job. And so like they're oftentimes basically their only life choice is sex work for the rest of their life because there's nothing else. And so that's really difficult.
Yeah. So obviously what you're describing is a situation in which the deck is stacked.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And when they are young...
And we need
young,
to think about that part too.
Yeah.
When they are young and this happens to them, they are on a track that they can't get off.
Yeah.
They need to have help. And they don't have the mental help.
No, I was just going to say, like, when the police pick up somebody young, this is probably a naive and foolish question. I sort of know the answer, but it just, of course, the ideal thing would be for the police then to get them into some kind of counseling or group home if it's a real young person. But I take it that that doesn't happen. They go through the court system, not the health or
health it system. Depends who picks you up.
Okay.
So it totally depends on the law enforcement officer. Because there's some really great law enforcement officers who are like, look, I know what you're doing, and I really recommend you get into this program.
Yeah.
But, you know, outside of the Triangle, a lot of those programs don't exist. Yeah. And the other problem that sometimes happens is the only programs that are available to people are religious-based, and individuals who may have come from that religious background, and they don't want to be involved with that because they got kicked out of their church for being gay, being lesbian, being trans, and they don't want to go back to a program that's going to be judgmental to them on that.
And probably punitive in its own way. Yeah.
And so, I mean, there are some really great religious-based programs in North Carolina for treatment and counseling. But it's not every program, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people just won't go. And then they kind of, we see this cycle.
And then I guess the penalties for those who are exploiting them or using them. I just read an article not too long ago, maybe in Mother Jones, I'm not sure, about child exploitation and sex trafficking or young people's sex trafficking. And the fine was for the guy who was doing the trafficking, which is really like the pimp, mm-hmm. was like, I don't know, $50, and it was a misdemeanor. Now, in Atlanta, this was all, it was focused on Atlanta, a group, a coalition got together, mm-hmm. like Harm Reduction Coalition, yeah. of faith-based and community groups, and they finally were able to make it a felony. But this is just relatively recently, and there's still holes in it. But can you imagine a $50 misdemeanor?
I can imagine. What we need is the state to be able to take care of the problem instead of expecting the faith-based organizations to do this. There should be a program of rehabilitation, mm-hmm. and counseling, mm-hmm. and home shelter, mm-hmm. for these people who are under 18, certainly mm-hmm. under 18. And you see them going into the prison system, and some of them have been, many of them are in the prison system because of drugs, mm-hmm. illicit drugs.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it becomes...
But this, you know, it was not just faith-based organizations. It was... It was Sojourners Magazine. But it was also community groups.
Right.
And this is what sometimes... This is sometimes what's needed to light a fire to the state, mm-hmm. you know, which maybe is not making that a priority. So sometimes it's that citizen activism, yeah. what you're doing, and that information getting out and people getting together and then pushing... their legislators for
That's
ideally.
Exactly where it needs to go. Yeah. Tell us a little more about the conference and who is
sure.
going to speak.
Yeah, well, thanks. So the conference again, which is September 8th and 9th in Research Triangle Institute's office in right outside of Durham, North Carolina, is we're going to have active sex workers, people who work with sex workers, such as our group and Women with a Vision from New Orleans. We're going to have active drug users. We're going to have military personnel. We're going to have law enforcement. We're going to have politicians from the Republicans and the Democrats. We're going to have people from Witness for Peace. We're going to have individuals who do policy. We're going to have more policymakers, public health officials, state officials, all at this conference talking about drugs and sex work and what we can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, what we're doing... is we're creating small media pieces, which we can then use to share amongst our allies throughout the South. And we have representation from every single Southern state attending. So it's going to be really a great mix of people talking about the Southern issues that oftentimes don't get covered by the national media. The South has, for example, the most people living with HIV, the most people living with viral hepatitis, and the least amount of funding to serve all those people out of any region in the country,
wow.
which doesn't make any sense. And President Obama recently came out with a 10 cities plan for addressing HIV and pretty much left out the South, even though we have the worst everything. And the big reason for that is because those other big cities such as New York, Chicago, LA. San Francisco, LA, like they have more petitioning power, right, than we do. Because oftentimes in the South, what makes us unique compared to the North, is with HIV and viral hepatitis, it's pretty much spread out pretty evenly amongst the population. So we don't have like a big population center where all the disease burden is. And so we have more in the state than most of the northern states, but we don't have those big population centers outside of Atlanta.
No clusters.
Doesn't it spread more when you have it like in North Carolina, because
yep.
you're reaching the people who live right yeah. near you.
Yeah.
And speaking of the South, one thing you did not mention, which I was just wondering about, is those meth labs. Isn't that pretty endemic in working class?
Yeah. The one thing that makes North Carolina unique is you can get pills like so easily.
Oh, that they don't need to.
Yeah, it does exist, and people do use meth, but it's so easy to get a prescription in North Carolina that why wouldn't you just get like the equivalent of the drug legally, and then you can't be arrested for it.
Okay.
And so that's kind of like the way most people get around it. Like
yeah.
in North Carolina, they'll you know, people write prescriptions for you pretty easily. And part of that as well is we have all these pharma companies here lobbying for the doctors to do
so. Oh,
okay. Not that there's a correlation, but...
so, I'm sure there is. Right.
So, yeah, that's a really big problem. And so that's why we also have a really big overdose problem, is because we write so many prescriptions for stuff.
Okay,
and also, you know, for example, I had a wisdom tooth pulled out and I was given like 60 oxycodone pills, right? And when I had that, right, I used half of one and I didn't touch the rest of the things. So I flushed them down the toilet. However, if I, for example, was a low-income person, don't have a gig, or a medium-income person and I need extra money, I can sell oxycodone pills for $80 a pop.
No kidding.
Yeah. So if I was, I could just sell the pill for $80. I could sell, like, you know, five of them and make rent. And I still got, you know, 55 to go. So, you know, that's what people are doing because it's easy.
They charge that much for them?
You can get that for an 80 milligram pill of oxycodone, yeah.
Oh,
it's a dollar per milligram as a general
rule. By the way, do not flush them down the toilet anymore. We're trying. That's another issue, is our water supply. But
that's
that,
right.
I know it's just a way of speaking.
Yeah,
but
I think.
Station break.
Oh, okay. Wait, hold on. We're going to do a station break, and then we're going to come back. This is all very, very interesting. Dick, do you want to, shall I start, or?
This is WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro, 103.5 on your FM dial, or streamed from the station's website, which is WCOMFM.org.
And we are brought to you, our underwriter is another one of our favorite places, Internationalist Bookstore, which is on 405 West Franklin Street. And like we always tell our listeners, it's not just a bookstore, although it's an excellent bookstore, but it is also a community resource center where the progressive community can find out everything that's going on. You can get great bumper stickers for your car so other people know how you feel about what's going on. And they also have movie night and craft night, and anybody in the progressive community who's gone to a conference or whatever usually then comes to the Internationalist to give a talk. So it's an exciting, wonderful place to go. And if they don't have the book that you want, they will order it for you.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I bought one of the rare books that I buy.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I'm going to the iStore because I know they'll have it. And they did.
What book was that?
It was the last one that they had, but it's called Deep Green Resistance.
Oh, we talked about that at our Wolf meeting. And by the way, this program is brought to you by WILP, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, WILPF. And you can find out more about us by going to trianglewilp.org.
Right.
Got that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Anything I'm leaving out? Oh, also, you can tell about that, because you do the work on this, that they can
Yeah. If you go to the trianglewilp.org website, you will find a place where the radio shows that we have done are archived.
Yes, they're archived.
Right, they're stored in an archive.
and
that you can play them back.
And most of them are pretty timely. There may be some announcements that are out of date, but the gist of what the issue is, recently we had a fantastic program by Dick and Tana Hartman on fracking, also on corporate personhood. We've had local issues. We've had the sanitation two workers on several times.
Yeah, we got to jump on the earthquake by about 2 weeks.
that's right.
With our fracking show.
The fracking can what be one of the causes now?
That's right.
Boy, that's the first thing I thought of. So, okay, you know how to get in touch with us, and our Wolf meetings are each month, and we'd love to have you come. And I just got to put a plug in for the Raging Grannies. The Raging Grannies are, a lot of WILF members are Raging Grannies, although not all Raging Grannies are WILF members. But we've been around for 13, 14 years, and we sing satirical words to old-timey music, and we wear colorful old-timey clothes. And we've been slowing up a little bit in the last year or two, and we're so happy and blessed that one of the most famous Raging Grannies in the country, Vicki Ryder, has just come to our area. So we're getting all, what do we say, reinspired, reinvigorated, and we're recruiting. So keep that in mind. The Raging Grannies are on the march again. Watch out. Now
you
back to
join.
Okay. Yes.
I wanted to while we're having a break, I wanted to ask if you have a website or a phone number or something for contact.
Sure. You can reach us on the World Wide Web at www.nchrc.net, and you can reach us via our general line, which is 336-543-8050. You can find us at Twitter at NC Harm Reduction, and you can find us on Facebook under North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition.
Wonderful. We'll do that at the end again.
And is there a special website about this conference that's coming up?
The conference you can find on our general website, which is, again, http://www.nchrc.net.
Okay. Something that we need to announce, and that is the dedication.
Oh, yes. I knew there was something. Dick, go for
okay.
it. Yes, this Sunday's so important.
Right, this coming Sunday at 2:30?
3:30. At 3 o'clock, I think.
3 o'clock? Okay, somewhere between 2:30 and 3:30.
Yeah, I think it's 3 o'clock. But be there at 2:30.
It's 3 to 4.
3 to 4. Okay, from 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock, the four names are being added to the plaques on the Peace and Justice Plaza,
which is the old post office on Franklin
Street.
Formerly
the post office, currently the court building.
Mm-hmm.
And the new names will be.
Yanni Chapman.
Rebecca Clark, right.
Dan Pollitt.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody else. Wonderful. We don't have this written. You can tell this is unscripted. We'll get back to that. But there's been these are names of activists who have had a part in this town's history of the struggle for civil rights.
And civil rights and also the peace movement.
And so we are, there's several names on, and these are being added. And is not this Sunday the anniversary of Martin Luther King's march in Washington,
and it's also the dedication
and
of the
dedication
memorial.
Of his new memorial. So this is why they picked this particular Sunday. So it's really, this is a way to come out locally to celebrate Martin Luther King Jr., all the wonderful people who are not known, the unsung heroes, a lot of women and children who were the big part of the civil rights movement in this country, of which it's one of the things that this country is still very proud of.
And one of the things that we need to be sure
a resurgence of
is that we have a resurgence of the work, that it's not the end but the beginning.
Yes. Absolutely. Amen to that, Dick. So we just gave you a lot of information, and we've got to tell you to have your pen and pencil ready.
And you, of course, wrote it all down, right?
So at the end, we will repeat at least some of it. We promise not all of it. But I want to get back to our guest, Ruth Zalf, our WILF and Raging Granny sister, and to our guest that she's brought, who is teaching us so much. Some of which we may have known, but a lot of which we did not know. And he's putting it together in context and with the statistics that give it so much scary meaning, Robert Child. So, Ruth?
Yes, I'd like you to speak a little bit more about the particular the biggest problem here in North Carolina Would you say it deals with law enforcement? Would you say it deals with the medical profession?
Are you talking in relation to drug use?
Mm-hmm.
So the biggest issues we've come across is the non-access of syringes for people who inject drugs.
Mm.
And the big problem is syringe exchange is illegal in North Carolina.
Is there any move to make syringes more available legally?
Yes. And so there's various things that have been done illegally, and there's various things that have been done legally. And what's happening legally is North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition has been working with legislators to craft a bill that would decriminalize syringes, and it's based off of law enforcement's rights. And what, again, which we identified earlier, that one in three members of law enforcement get a needle stick. In North Carolina, 28% of them will get multiple needle sticks. And we know if we decriminalize syringes, that needle sticks go down to law enforcement by 66%.
Wow.
And we know if syringe exchange is legalized, the same thing happens. It goes down by 66%. And it's, the whole thing is based off members of law enforcement basically getting actual truthful answers from people on whether they have a syringe on them. And again, we know about 1 in 12 people has a syringe on them in North Carolina. And so it's really important that, you know, a bill like this gets pushed through. Unfortunately, the last bill was introduced by a Democrat. And so what's happening is a lot of the Democrats' bills are just being blockaded entirely and put in committees where they basically go to die.
So would you suggest that the public write to their legislators and say, we want you to pass a bill that would legalize the purchase of needles?
Yeah, and so the bill was introduced into the legislature. One of our sponsors was Orange County's Verla Insko, and we also have talked to Senator Kennard about it, and she's supportive of the issue. The big problem is, since it was a Democrat-introduced bill, it got put into a committee basically to die. So right now we're working with the Tea Party, who are pro this issue, because they're pro-decriminalization, and we have a representative who is actually going to come to the conference, who is a member of the Tea Party and wants to help decriminalize syringes.
Great. Wonderful.
That is great.
Wonderful.
And so we're going to talk to them about trying to put a rider into an existing law or to put an amendment on a current bill to try and get it in there.
And what is the cost of needles? These syringes.
Sure. So a syringe costs about 5 cents.
Yeah. As long as it's not a criminal act, the cost is not an issue.
Yeah.
I wanted to just, Dick remembered the fourth member whose name is going to go on the engraved in the Peace and Justice Plaza this coming Sunday, and it's Charles Jones, who is an iconic figure here. He was the one who started the community church. He was involved in the civil rights struggle back in the 50s when the Freedom Riders came through, risked his life and limb, and his family was at risk. So I think a lot of people here know who we're talking about, and we certainly want to be sure his name is out there. So we'll have more. We could really do a program with a short biography of each of these wonderful people: Rebecca Clark, Yanni Chapman, Charles Jones, and I always leave one person out.
Dan Pollitt.
And Dan Pollitt. Yes, that would be a nice program to have, a very positive one. I want to just switch gears a little bit and ask Robert a little bit about yourself. Where are you from, and how did you get interested in this and involved in this?
So I'm originally from Wales. And then, I moved to England, to Germany, to South Africa, to Chicago, to Oregon, to New Hampshire, to Brooklyn, to here.
Okay.
Now I was raised by African parents, so that really has complicated my accent.
How did that happen? Can you tell us how that happened?
A little bit of love in London. That's how I came into being. My mom is from South Africa, and my dad's from Tanzania, and my mom was pretty much blacklisted for rebelling against the apartheid regime in South Africa. And so she went to England, and my dad went to university in South Africa and also got kicked out. And then they met in London when they decided to tour Europe in a VW bus. Very traditional. Get together.
That's a wonderful, romantic story. And, you know, and no wonder you come by your activist genes, you know, from the very beginning. That's lovely. So it's been a long journey.
Yeah, it's genetic.
It's a genetic journey. Yeah, they traveled around.
Yeah, and so, like, the other genetic thing I have is, since I'm British, I do like gardening. And so, after graduating from undergrad in Lewis and Clark out in Portland, what happened is the only job I could get was gardening. My history degree wasn't paying off too many dividends. And so I got a job gardening, and I was running a garden and farm for mentally ill adults and drug users. And that's how I started to get interested. And I was helping them become self-sufficient. So if you're bipolar manic or high on cocaine, I had you moving the compost or digging holes. You know, if you're OCD, I have you do the seeding and the cuttings. Like, each people, you know, some people would view it as like a negative, and I was viewing it as a positive for the garden, and then everybody gets to take home the wealth of the garden.
I want to get your number by the end of this because one of my daughters is just graduating from Central Carolina Community College in Sustainable Agriculture, and one of her friends, who is from Brooklyn and an African American, that's his dream to do what you did.
Yeah,
you
it was
know,
fun.
is to set up some kind of a small farm thing, and helping people who've had drug or other kinds of problems like that, really believing, like it sounds like you did, that through nature and that kind of physical work in the garden. But that'll be another program. We'll have to have you back and talk about the gardening. So I'm getting off topic.
Yeah, but that kind of fits in. I do prison ministry, and at Yorkville's, we have brought seeds, and they have planted a garden there at the prison.
Okay, in Hillsborough?
And in Hillsborough.
Good for you, Ruth.
And a lot of the men enjoy gardening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, they keep up the place.
Yeah.
And it's a fairly large facility. They mow the grass, and they weed the gardens, and they have flowers. And
do they grow a lot of their food?
But I don't know that they grow good bit of their food,
but they
have been growing vegetables.
Wonderful.
So it can be very helpful.
This could be another whole program on on food. And well, the coming Dick, we'll talk some more at another program about this book, Deep Green Resistance. But the way things are going with poor Mother Nature in this land, it would behoove all of us to learn some gardening skills and survival skills of all sorts. So, do you garden still?
I do, yeah. And my wife's actually going to take a gardening course at North Carolina. I think, I can't remember which school it was. But, yeah, we run a little farm that we do some stuff with. And, yeah, it's awesome.
Oh, and where is that at?
I live over in Chapel Hill.
So it's in Chapel Hill.
Yeah. Just biking distance away.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. Okay, I can just see several programs now sprouting.
Right.
I wanted to know if there's any other part of harm reduction besides stuff oriented towards drugs.
Yeah, I mean, you can take the harm reduction approach to anything, really, that's a health-related behavior. So we used a driving example earlier by using seatbelts, right? Another approach that's oftentimes utilized is by medical doctors when they're working with treatment-resistant patients. Now, say, for example, the one I like to use is, say, for example, we have somebody who's like an overweight diabetic, right? And they're just like, I love donuts. They're delicious. There's no way you're going to make me stop eating 6 donuts a day, right? And so, like, the harm reduction approach might be, well, can we look at what kind of donuts you're eating, right? Could we have you use, like, a donut that's a little healthier to eat? Could it be that you eat 5 donuts instead of 6? Could it be that we have you drink a giant glass of water before each donut, which, you know, basically makes you too full to, you know, take it down. So, you know, those would all be harm reduction approaches to that. So it's basically just a model that you can use to any health behavior. So one of the things we do, going back to a drug reference, because I love to talk about drugs, is with the crack users, right? So we have 171,000 crack users in North Carolina. And what happens is they all share that crack pipe. And as we learned earlier, like with needles, hepatitis C lives on the crack pipe for 3 to 6 months. And what happens if you smoke crack is the way you can imagine the crack pipe, which they smoke it with, is a lot like a pen. And so basically on the end of the pen is where they're breathing it through. And if you're using it a lot, what happens is it tends to just get messed up because some people drop it after smoking. So it gets kind of sharp and jagged. And then everybody's putting that lip on their lips, which is cutting their lips. The other thing is the pipe gets super hot. And so when the pipe gets super hot, it burns your lips. So people are getting blood on the end of the pipe. Now we know up to 50 people are sharing a pipe, right? That's not out of the usual. And so anybody who's sharing that, they're getting burnt lips with, you know, where they can get hep C exposure through the cuts on the burn, and also the pipe may be sharp, so they can get cut from it. And so everybody's normally getting hep C. When we test people for hepatitis C, when we test crack users, it's almost 100% of people have it in North Carolina because of the pipe sharing. The other thing is we think in prison and jail that nobody's using drugs. They are using drugs, right? I can tell from my giggle to the left that we have agreement. So what's happening is in prison and jail is even worse, and we're seeing like 100 people per syringe, and we're seeing, you know, 150 to 200 people per pipe. And what happens then is everybody's sharing it, and people in prison and jail have super high rates of HIV, have super high rates of viral hepatitis, and so a lot of people are getting transmitted through that. So the harm reduction approach is we teach people to smoke it safer so they don't transmit hepatitis, right? So hepatitis, again, costs, you know, up to $120,000 to treat. We don't want people to, and the public, to have to deal with that cost. So what we do is we just give people spark plug covers that they then can put over the pipe, and then you keep your spark plug cover. You can share your pipe, and since you put the spark plug cover over the pipe, you don't get hepatitis C.
A regular spark plug
cover. It costs us like 10 cents a pop, right?
Mm.
And so they're doing it. They're doing it anyway, no matter what you say, right? And so why don't we reduce the disease burden? Why don't we reduce the financial burdens? You know, very simple thing.
So I was going to say the big part of it is not making a judgment on the person and saying, just say no, you shouldn't do that. But it's how, if you're going to do this behavior, how can we help you figure out how to make it safer?
Right.
And for both for your sake and for the community at large.
Absolutely. Right? And the big problem is the detoxers want to do a great job with people who do go in for this. But one of the huge issues is normally they only go in for 2 weeks because that's all the city or county would subsidize the program. Mm-hmm. So a lot of we work with a lot of drug treatment programs, and they're like, we actually don't like you guys too much, but we view you as necessary because we can't, you know, work with a lot of individuals because we need to see them for a longer time, and we're only being paid to see them for 2 weeks. So people, you know, drug treatment for 2 weeks for like somebody who's been using 10 years, it ain't really going to be much. And oftentimes, as folks are going back to the same communities where all the same things are going on.
And then they get back in jail again.
Exactly. Yeah. Or they go to the methadone program where everybody they don't want to see is there. And so that leads to a lot of issues.
Yeah. Now, how expensive are the blood tests for hepatitis B and C?
Yeah, so that depends who's testing. And so if you have LabCorp over another source, it really varies on the rate. We like using tests that give instant results, and those tend to cost in between $35 and $50. But it's really providing the individual the knowledge of if they have a disease.
Yeah.
Like, they want to know.
Can they get that free of charge at the social services?
No, not all the time.
Health department?
Not all the time. So, but you can get them for free and without judgment from us. So, you know, they can look us up on the net, nchrc.net. They can call us on the phone, 336-543-8050. They can snail mail me.
Let me get that number again. Say that number. I wasn't ready. Let me pick my pen up.
Sure.
Please pick your pen up. Be ready.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's 336-543-8050. 8050. And you can snail mail us. You can write us an email. We like that as well. But we really encourage people. I mean, if you have a question about testing, you have a question about how to do a drug safer, if you have a question on how to reverse a drug overdose, we'll teach you all those things. If you have a question about how do I work with sex workers in a safer way, how do I do effective advocacy to advocate for legislative change, you can contact us and we're willing to help.
That's wonderful. Yeah. So,
what about the old standby needle exchange?
Yes. So there's 5 underground syringe exchange programs in North Carolina. We have a great one out in Asheville. There's another one out in Winston-Salem. There's one in Greensboro. There's a trans-only exchange in Carrboro. And there's one in Durham. And there's talk of one starting up at Fort Bragg as well, because there's a lot of people in the military that are injecting.
I bet.
Yeah.
That sounds like a really good place to do that. Yeah. Yeah.
But all those programs are illegal. And there's been 2 arrests of people doing syringe exchange in North Carolina. There is 1 arrest in Charlotte.
It's illegal to do what?
Syringe exchange.
Do you mean to help with the needle? That's illegal to help?
It's illegal, yeah.
It's illegal to supply one to somebody who doesn't have a prescription for it. So by definition, if you give it to somebody...
But if they know that you're going around trying to help...
Well, it's funny because the Asheville program is above ground. Like, the police know it's happening. And they're like, this makes sense. I don't see what the big deal is. And they kind of let it be.
Okay.
Because it helps.
I was thinking.
But in Charlotte and Greensboro, they haven't been that friendly.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it's city by city where it depends.
So in Greensboro and Charlotte, watch out.
Charlotte
epidemic
doesn't
is...
Yeah. Even though, like, Charlotte has the most injectors, right? They're the ones freaking out, maddest about it.
Yeah.
Because, like, a lot of people feel that syringe exchange actually encourages drug use.
Yeah.
But
it's
every single place
aspect.
Where a syringe exchange has existed, drug use in the community actually goes down. Because suddenly there's a place for all the people doing drugs to go and talk to somebody who's not going to judge them and offer them referrals for care that matter for them, right? And they work off stages of change theory, which means let's meet people where they're at. So by meeting you where you're at, you may be ready for an HIV test and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe meeting you at is like you've come 20 times and now you want to go to detox, and we give you that detox referral and it will actually work because it was their decision, not our decision.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to have to wrap this up now because there's another show coming on right behind us. We want to thank you for coming, Robert.
Yes, Robert, thank you. We want you back.
Give us a quick 5 seconds description of the event at RTI.
Sure. So the event at RTI, you can find out details at www.nchrc.net. is a conference on drug use and sex work in North Carolina and throughout the South, and it will be on September 8th and 9th.
Okay, and we should also remind you about Sunday.
Sunday
at Peace and Justice
Plaza, downtown Chapel Hill.
See if we can get all 4 of the people this time: Dan Pollitt, Charlie Jones, Yanni Chapman, and Rebecca Clark. Not necessarily in that order.
Yes, wonderful. You've done well, kid.
And we got to go now.
See you next week for
Lori Hoyt and Ruth Zalf, and we'll see you or talk to you next week.
Next week.
And thank you very much. This is WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro.
Your wonderful low-power radio station.